we were like in the height. We were doing Madonna videos. Yeah. We were doing Guns N' Roses. Mm-hmm. You know, we were doing everything. It was just like it was the place to be.
Yeah.
Right. You were there.
Yeah.
You lived there. They even had a cafe in there, which people just came just to hang out.
Yeah.
It was just that kind of a place.
It's like Google, but early.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was like. Yeah. It was like Google, but early. It was the coolest place to work.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of CineNation. I am Brandon Sparks, and I'm alone on this intro for this episode. So this was a fun episode. I got to interview Larry Shapiro, and Larry is the CEO of Ensemble Digital Studios. And I met Larry a few months back through a class at USC. My professor, Tim Marks, Thomas was actually the SA, the student assistant in this class. And so Larry came in one night to cover for our professor, and Larry was just this huge personality, and he had so many great stories, and I really hoped to get him on the podcast, and I didn't tell him that when I met him. And so I waited a few months, and I shot him an email and asked him to come on, and he graciously gave me like an hour and a half to sit down and talk with him about his career and kind of what he's doing now. And it was just a fun episode. Larry, I don't talk that much in this because I had like kind of some questions. I had people send me questions for this. But Larry, I think it ended up being a much better episode because Larry could just tell these great stories of him starting out. And it was a period of time that I don't know much about. And we talk about the music video craze and how he got started off doing that through Propaganda Films, which is this big, one of the biggest music video companies of that era. And Larry makes some great comparisons to music videos back then to like YouTube content now. It was a fun episode, and I'm so happy Larry came on, and we talked for an hour and a half. Like, I met him one morning before him and his assistant Emmy went to a production of some kind. Larry now is through his company Ensemble. He's working with a lot of YouTube personalities. Scott DW is one. They do just a bunch of online content, and he has a lot of great stuff out, the people he's working with, and excited to see like what they're doing and what Larry is doing. So it was a fun episode, and we talk a little about just what's going on kind of currently. This past weekend, like Beauty and the Beast made $170 million, and we recorded this before then, so we kind of mentioned Emma Watson and Beauty and the Beast before it became this humongous hit, which I think if you paid attention to the numbers, you would have realized it'd be a big hit. I don't think really many people saw it as this big of a hit, making $170 million an opening weekend for March. And I think it's the opening record for a March opening ever. And I think it's the seventh largest opening ever. It eclipsed the Harry Potter record, which granted, you can count inflation for a little bit, but still, it's a big deal, especially for Emma Watson being as this person who's known for Harry Potter. But we talk a little bit about her because she's known for her big social media presence. Even though she really, when you look at her filmography, she hasn't done a lot of movies since Harry Potter. She's been very selective with her work, and so Beauty and the Beast is kind of a big change for her, and it gives she's able to release a film that she's in to a larger audience, and it kind of shows. I think Beauty and the Beast did well because of Emma Watson had something to do with the success of Beauty and the Beast. I mean, I think Beauty and the Beast still would have made a lot of money without her. We might go into this in a later episode, but her presence, her social media presence, her online presence through her political stuff to just who she is a big deal. I mean, my mother rarely goes to movies anymore. She rarely goes to movies. I think she averages me like two a year. And she just called me when she went to Beauty and the Beast and like loved it. And Emma Watson, and she loved the original movie, but I think Emma Watson, because she really loves Emma Watson, had something to do with her getting out, driving to the movie theater and seeing it. And she's even talking about going to see it a second time. Very few stars have that ability. And I think Emma Watson could be on the brink of that. Again, we might discuss this at a later date, later episode, because I think it's an interesting thing to discuss. and analyze with the Disney live action stuff and with the stars of those films. But anyway, so this is a great episode with Larry Shapiro. I really hope you enjoy it. Make sure you follow us on iTunes, subscribe to us, give us a review, give us a rating. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Cinenation Show. Make sure you look at us on Medium. We have a, Larry talks a lot about a couple of things he worked on, the music videos and things we discuss in the show. I'm probably going to do a Medium article of all the links so you can see everything that we talked about. So check out our Medium page at Cinenation. It's great. There's a lot of great articles coming out daily. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this episode with Larry Shapiro.
He's a big comic book geek, uh-huh. Big fan geek.
And so he's doing comic books and...
Theater and comic books and heavy metal.
So. I minored in theater, so yeah. That's an interesting mix of things. Heavy metal and... Does he play guitar? Is that what it is?
No, he sings.
He sings?
Okay. He's a singer. And he's into heavy metal and comic books. And I'm like, find a way to jam heavy metal, comic books, and theater all together, man. And you're good.
He's going to do a Broadway musical of a comic book adaptation. But like...
Right, exactly.
With heavy metal.
Exactly.
A better Spider-Man. Yeah, exactly.
That's him. That's him.
And what year is he right now?
He's a freshman.
Okay. Yeah, wow.
He's finishing up freshman year.
Oh man.
Yeah.
That's insane. He went to school here, I guess.
He went to SAMA.
Yeah, okay. Wow. SAMA. Yeah. How's the transition for him up there?
He loves it.
Okay.
He needed to get out of here. He was just like, I'm out of here.
Done. That's good because I went from like being an undergrad. I was in my hometown. I went to undergrad. So we went from like I went from Alabama for my 4 years and then came out here right after. So
right.
It was good to get away from.
You have to leave the home.
Yeah, you do.
You gotta leave. You gotta leave the roost, and that's that's what happened to me. I was like, I went to Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I was a theater major at Michigan for 2 years, and people ask, why'd you go to Michigan? I was like, it was the furthest school I got into. It was just like it's the furthest school I got into, and I was a theater major there, and studying acting, and got to a point in my acting where I just felt like I just couldn't break through. Just, I don't know if it was for me or if I couldn't let myself go or if I was too self-conscious. And then I started taking film classes at Michigan. And in my class was Mike Patterson and he actually was the guy who... Mike Patterson was... one of my classmates was Dan Patterson.
Okay,
Dan Patterson. Who did Whose Line Is It Anyway? Who ultimately wound up doing Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yeah.
And he's this English guy, and it was hysterically funny. And the film that he did, I was like, I did sound for him, and it was Everything You Wanted to Know About Film. But didn't go to UCLA. That was the title. Because we were like Michigan. And I played an NYU film student in the film as well as doing sound. But so I started. I was a theater major and then got into the film classes, and really got into it. And the professor let me take the grad school course. So I was on. I was like with all these grad students, and having fun and editing and doing it. And then Robert Altman came.
Oh wow.
Michigan to film a movie called Secret Honor with Philip Baker Hall as Nixon. And I got a job on set and I was Steve Altman's assistant. So I was like, the prop assistant on set of this movie. And I was just watching Robert Altman, like every day I'd be like on set watching Robert Altman direct.
Which is amazing.
Which was amazing.
That's like some of the best like film school class you could probably take.
Exactly. I was like, and that's exactly what happened. It was like, I finished the movie and I was like, fuck this, man. I'm going behind the camera. This is where it's at. This is like, it was so cool. And it was so seducing to just watch a master like Altman direct, knowing that I wasn't a director, but I was like, I'm going to be behind the camera. This is what it's all about. And then literally And that was my sophomore year.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, all right, I'm transferring. Mm-hmm. And I applied to UCLA. Mm-hmm. I applied to USC and applied to NYU. Mm-hmm. And I got into NYU. Mm-hmm. And it was like, bam, I went to NYU film school and started working. NYU was really cool. The film scene at NYU, and this was back in the 80s, right? This was 84, 85. And, you know, we had just had the advent of MTV, mm-hmm. right? MTV started in the 80s. So it's like
post,
2 years in.
It's pro right? Spike Lee at NYU Tisch, I assume.
You know, it was, yeah. And it was, so it was NYU. It was before, they were just building the new film school. So we all got screwed. We were like in the beat up buildings yep. and working with the old, you know, IMAs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But New York was a different film scene. It was like your independent films and commercials. Mm-hmm. And so I was taking these film classes and we were shooting our little films in Washington Square Park and stuff like that. And I remember watching a film in one of the producing courses that I was taking, and the film was so well done. It was so well done. And I walked up to the director after, didn't know who he was. And I said, hey man, that was really good. You know, I was like, I like to produce. And if you ever have anything to produce, I'd love to produce it for you and stuff like that. He goes, oh yeah, hey, cool man. That's great. That's great. And we started walking. I remember we were literally walking through Washington Square Park. And I said, you know, the actors are really good. I said, that kid was really good. Is like, you know, or his parents, you know, in the business or whatever. Because I was, you know, I was a Jersey kid. Yeah. I didn't know from Hollywood. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, well, his parents are actors and stuff like that. I was like, oh, would I have heard of them? You know, I thought they were like theater yeah. actors on Broadway and stuff like that. And he's like, well, his father's Elliot Gould. His mom's Barbara Streisand. The kid was Jason Gould.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, Oh, okay. Great.
Oh, yeah, that's where I knew him from.
That's why he's good. Yeah. You know, that's why he was comfortable in front of the camera. It's like, oh, that's cool. I was like, oh, are your parents in the business? He goes, oh, my dad's in music. I was like, oh, great. That's great. Now, again, I was like PAing on commercials and stuff like that. So my head was like, that's all I knew.
Yeah.
I was like, so I figured his dad wrote like commercial jingles and he was like one of those New York kind of, you know, musicians that did it. And so we became friends. Never knew his last name or anything like that. And all I knew him is Jesse. And he's like, hey, Larry, I got a script. Can you break it down in budget for me? I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, absolutely. So I walk with him to his locker. He hands me the script. I look at the script and I read down and it says, Jesse Dillon. And I was like, oh, okay, this is Bob Dylan's kid. I was like, oh, all right. But the thing is, I never really knew who he was. And I was, you know, my relationship was authentic.
Yeah.
And so we became friends. And, mm-hmm. and I was like, you know, I was, you know, his producer and his AD in college and things like that. And it's funny because when I graduated, yeah, so it was really weird. You're like in NYU and it's like, you know, you have kids like, you know, Jesse Dillon and like in the editing room is like Jenny Lumet. And,
oh, wow.
You know, and you're like, you're just like, it's kind of like foreign. You're just like this little Jersey kid, just like trying to make things work. And
I don't know how I got here.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And yep. then like, you know, we're you know, with Jesse's, I remember Jesse's senior project we produced. There was like Vincent Gardenia was in it.
Oh, wow.
And Lisa was in it, and the big fight promoter Don King was in it. You know what I mean? It was just like, you know, the kid was like in high school, the kid was in college, and you know, he's rep by CAA, and we had all like real actors in this thing, and it was a fun little movie. And but you know, when we all graduated and stuff like that, I got a job. One of my classmates. And that's the thing about film school, right? Mm-hmm. You meet a group of kids,
yeah.
and that's your crew.
Yeah.
Those are the people who are going to get you your next job.
Yeah.
Those are the people who you bond with, and that's the most important thing, and that's why film school is important. It's like, it's not so much about learning how to make films, right? Because kids know how to do that anyway. My son at 15 is editing on Final Cut Pro. Yeah. You know, he's got his 5D camera, he's got his glide cam, he's got his shoulder cam. He knows how to make films. He knows how to make films using the editing software from Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
I mean, he makes beautiful films. But film school is really about finding those crews and those people, because those are going to be relationships that you carry through. That's going to be your class that you rise up with. In you know, right. You're going to be hanging out with kids. You're going to be, you know, you're going to be finding those kids in film school, and you're going to have those connections. That's why it's always great to not be a dick in school. And it's like, work hard and be nice to everyone.
Because you don't know who's going to be,
who's the person's
going to help you out. Because right. I think I remember like hearing a story. I don't know how true this is, but I remember someone talking about someone they knew that they were working on a film set, and like the director was kind of a dick to his like gaffer, and like wasn't that nice to her. And then it ends up being like Lena Dunham is who the gaffer was, right. And you're like, you really don't know,
I mean, right?
Because in this business, it does deal with talent, but also sometimes a little bit of luck of who's going to move up.
You just never know. It's always that dark horse.
Yeah.
It's always that dark horse, that person in the corner that turns out to be Tim Burton.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, that's the thing. And I learned that later on in life, right? But it's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I'm in school and I'm like, you know, my locker was next to Alex Winter.
Oh, wow.
You know, but I hardly ever talk to him. You know what I mean? It's like I see him at his own house every so often. I say, hey, Alexander, blah, blah, blah. But it's just like,
you
never, never know. And so that's what's important to me. Like, if I was to say anything, it's just be nice and work hard. That's it. No judgment on anyone. You just never know. Mm-hmm. I have kids having lectures that I speak at film schools, one last night, and they were just, she was constantly like trying to push my buttons, trying to bring up light. And I was like, get that chip off your shoulder. You're not doing any service to anybody. And, you know, so these people will get you your next job.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine from theater class, actually from Michigan, got me my first job. Mm-hmm. She moved to New York to get involved in theater. Now she's actually a big casting director. Her name is Laura Stanzik on Broadway. And she got me my first job on a real film where I actually got paid. And that movie was called...
Is this the one?
Starlight. No, that movie was called Starlight. Uh-huh. Okay. And...
Is this the one in South Carolina? Or
No. This was up in... Boston. This was up in like New England. We shot. It was called Starlight. And interestingly enough, there was a young girl there, and we bonded. She was like an overweight girl, and she was so funny and just so nice. And I was like this PA. I remember the first day on set. I was had my walkie-talkie, and the minute they throw a walkie-talkie on you, you just
feel
think,
so official.
You think you are the king. You are like the master. And the AD was like this hardcore New York AD. Mm-hmm. It was my first day on the job. And you hear over the walkie-talkie, and his name is Aaron Barsky, the AD. And he's done a lot of movies. And he's like, I need a PA down here with a paper towel. And I was like right by Craft Services. And I was like, paper towel, great. Grab the paper towel, and I raced to set. I ran to set, and I was like, "Here it is." Thinking like, "I saved the day. The movie is going to hinge on this paper towel." And he looks at me, just like, "Not even." He's like, "Great, pick up the dog shit on the lawn so the crew doesn't step in it." You know what I mean? I was like, "But I picked up that dog shit." I was like, "Boom, boom, boom! You got it, man.
My
you
big
know.
Chance."
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you know what? He hired me again.
Yeah, they remember you from that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but that girl who I met on one of the actresses turned out to be Ricky Lake.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Pre-Hairspray.
Yeah, pre-Hairspray. Mm-hmm. This was like one of her first gigs.
Yeah.
And so you just never know. And then Tashina Arnold was also in that movie, who wound up being in Little Shop of Horrors, and she became one of the Fly Girls and stuff like that on Living Color.
One thing you said, you talked about that you didn't want to be a director. What made you, like, from the beginning know that you didn't want to direct, you wanted to do producing? Or that's what your first...
You know, I'm not a reader. I don't like to read. But, I did direct a couple of things, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it just ever hooked in. Or, you know what it... I think what happens in film school is you start to fall into something, fall into a rhythm. It's like you're on this vibrating machine and there's all these little holes and mm-hmm. you're like all these little nuts and you know, and all of a sudden, you know, the machine keeps vibrating and then you just fall into a particular hole mm-hmm. because it fit. I remember that I wasn't a cameraman.
Yeah.
So I remember in one of my camera classes, I put theater makeup on an actor thinking that it was going to work. not really understanding
how
that you're not
close you
50.
Get to the, yeah.
Right. And I was just like, oh, that sucked. You know what I mean? I was just like, it was like this little cabin scene. There was supposed to be a fire in the distance. And I had like these like red and blue lights outside. And it just looked so bad. I was like, well, I'm not a cameraman. And I don't know if I had the patience. Like, I love working with mm-hmm. actors. I really do.
Yeah.
I just don't know. I just didn't have that. Being a film director is just so precise, and it takes patience. I don't know if I had the patience. I loved editing.
Yeah.
I loved working with my hands. Loved editing. Should have been an editor. But what I loved about producing was... I like putting things together, man.
Yeah.
I just like sitting on the set and putting all the things together and kind of guiding the ship that way. And I was good at it. And it worked for me. It was like, okay, that's what I do. It's like you get in and you try the different roles and it's just like, okay, well, you know, props, you know, I wanted to be Rick Baker at one point in time. I loved makeup and I loved that kind of, you know, working with my hands and things like that. But this was even more like now as a producer, you get to really kind of work with your hands because you're putting things together and you're building it. So that's kind of what I fell into. And the AD Aaron Barsky, who met me on my first movie, mm-hmm. took me on my second movie, which is where I met Tim Marks.
Yeah.
And that movie was a mini series in South Carolina. For like 3 months. That was like a 3 month gig. And that was called Roanoke. And that mm-hmm. was a period piece about the lost colony of Roanoke in South Carolina. And I was in the AD department. I was like the set PA.
Mm-hmm.
And I had so much fun and I ran for everything and everyone saw me running. And it's funny because we had to light a lot of smoke bombs and stuff like that. Had to do a lot of things. And we were living in the mud,
mm-hmm.
okay? Like, literally, we had chain gangs build roads.
Oh, my gosh.
Literally, months before the crew even show up, because it was a
1500s. Yeah.
It was a period piece. So we had to be away from everything, power lines, everything. And so, literally, and you're in South Carolina, and it was in the rainy season, and we were living in the mud. So I had a lighter, mm-hmm. right? And I taped it to a piece of string and put it on a carabiner so it just hung, you know? So when anyone was like, needed a smoke or whatever, I always had it ready. And the only reason why I put it on a piece of rope was so I didn't drop it and it would wind up in the mud. But everyone just thought that was just so cool. It was like, oh, here's this guy. He's prepared.
He's on a rope.
Right. He's hacking things to get it done.
Yeah.
And he was always running. Mm-hmm. I always ran everywhere on set.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw that. And that's why when I forgot to pick up, that's why I didn't get fired when I forgot to pick up the actors one time. Because what happened was, did I tell you the story?
I think you did.
So we were in South Carolina and there was a hurricane coming
uh-huh.
and all our sets were made out of wood and mud, right? So we're like,
you're just like, this is going to be a disaster.
This is going to be a disaster. And we took over a school as our production office, a school that was decommissioned, and that turned out to be our hurricane shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember Peggy Jacobson, the second AD, throws me the keys to the van and says, Larry, go pick up all the actors at their condos. And all the actors are like in this little condo village right on the water.
Yeah.
Right on the water. And I picked up all the actors. The guy played John White, Victor Garber, who was in Titanic.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, great actor. Paul Guilfoyle, mm-hmm. Who's been in a lot of stuff. You know, who was also in this was Esposito. He was in Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he was the drug kingpin guy. Carlos Esposito?
Yeah. The guy who owns the chicken place.
He was there, picked him up and stuff like that. And Will Sampson, who plays Chief in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
isn't
it as well?
Oh, okay.
And this was, we had all these Native Americans, the Ojibwe Indians from Minnesota come, mm-hmm. and there were some rifts between, mm-hmm. you know, almost like East versus West.
Yeah.
You know, we got from all over the country because it was had to be authentic. And they were going to have a peace pipe smoking mm-hmm. ceremony as we were all sheltered in, you know, as the hurricane started coming. And no one could find Will Sampson.
And it was your job to pick him up.
Right. And I had to pick him up. And no one could find him. And Peggy said, Larry, do you know where Will is? I was like, I don't know. And she's like, did you pick him up? And it was like that one of those things like, oh my God.
I could lie here. But right. You exactly, know I would be
exactly,
lying.
Exactly. I was like, oh no. And she's like, go get him now. And I'm driving and the rain is like coming down sideways, yes. You know?
And southern rain is yeah.
It's hardcore.
Yeah.
You know, this is a hurricane coming, you know? And I'm sitting there driving, like, right by the water, picking up Will. And Will, with all his amazing grace, is just standing there, like Chief in Cuckoo's Nest, on the porch, just waiting to be picked up. Rain's coming down, and I was like, hey, Will. And he's like, you know?
He
just
gets in the car.
Yeah, he just gets in the car. And I drive back, and I thought I was getting fired, but you know, Tim Marks, the mm-hmm. producer, was like, you know what, everyone loves you. I'm giving you a second chance. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, typically you'd be mm-hmm. on the next plane back to New York.
Yeah.
But those people got me my job. Mm-hmm. And you work and then they start keeping you hired and mm-hmm. you start to fall into a rhythm. So I became, you know, I became an AD.
Yeah.
And I started working in the AD department. I was on set and I, you know, was being trained. One of the ADs I worked with recommended me to another AD, mm-hmm. Steve Love, who hired me on this other movie called The Beat, which was produced by Julia Phillips, uh-huh. who produced The Sting. And she was so cool. A stunning and mm-hmm. smart lady. And then he went on to AD another movie called Bloodhounds of Broadway.
Okay.
And I was the second AD on that movie. And that was directed by Howard Bruckner.
Mm-hmm.
And that starred Rucker Hauer, Matt Dillon, Jennifer Grey,
oh, wow.
Madonna.
That's very 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, yeah. It was like late 80s. It's like 87, uh-huh. something like that. And I was the second AD on that. And that was great. And then I took a vacation out to visit some friends in California.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in California when that took that movie. But I got out to California because I took a vacation.
Yeah.
Took a vacation to meet to stay with some friends in LA who I knew from Michigan. Right? Again,
yeah.
People who you work with at school, they're mm-hmm. so important. That's where you make all your contacts. So I came out to LA on a vacation to meet some friends from Michigan, and I was staying with my friend Susan Savage on her couch. And when I was in New York, I PA'd. I was a PA, a set PA on a music video for Janet Jackson.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Now, this was Janet Jackson. The director was Dom Senna. The producer was Howard Wolfenden. And the executive producer of this company was, his name was Steve Golan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lot of big people.
Right.
Yeah.
So Steve Golan, who just, you know, won an Oscar last year for The Revenant.
Yeah.
So they had, you know, it was this small company called Propaganda Films. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they were filming this Janet Jackson. The video was called Let's Wait a While. and we filmed it in February in New York on a rooftop. Okay, you can imagine how cold it was. It was so bloody cold. But I was a PA on that, and the producer liked me. You know, so I did my job, and you know, ran around and stuff like that. Didn't matter if it was like 2 degrees and the wind was blowing, but it was just like boom. So when I came out to LA, I was staying on a couch, and I said, you know, I'm just going to call the producer Howard just to say hi, maybe go for a beer with him and stuff like that. And I called him up, and he's British. And he's like, oh, great. Hey, how you doing, man? He's like, what are you doing this weekend? And I was like, I don't know. He goes, well, I'm producing this music video for Dom again, and we need an AD. You know, have you ever been a first AD before? And I lied.
Yeah,
exactly. I was like, yeah, I was a first AD in college, yeah, you know, on Jesse Dillon's picture.
Yep.
But I was like, yeah. He's like, oh, great, man. And he's like, you know, I can only afford to pay you like, you know, $300. I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah, like, well, of course.
I guess I'll have to exactly. do that.
Well, this time.
This time I'll do that. But next time you'll have to do my rate.
Right, exactly. And so I was a first AD for, I forgot the band's name, but it was Dom Senna again.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for this young company called Propaganda Films. And I AD'd, and this company, this was job number 8 at this company,
uh-huh.
right? Janet Jackson was like job 6.
Yeah.
This was like job 8. And Howard liked me, and it was young, and everyone was young there, and everyone was just starting out. There were all these, you know, young directors and things like that.
Which is a great place to be.
Right. Like, yeah. That's where you want to be. You want to find where your generation is starting their careers. You don't want to just go out there and like, oh, I'm going to work at Warner Brothers or whatever.
Yeah.
It depends what your career goals are.
Yeah.
But it's like, stay with your, you know. And the great thing about Propaganda was, they were making, you know, MTV was literally starting to hit its prime. And this was this wacky 3 to 4 minute format that teens were watching.
Yeah.
Just like YouTube videos today. And so this was the choice of entertainment for teenagers. And I got in and I started working at Propaganda Films. And literally, this company just took off. And I was out on vacation and I never went back.
Yeah.
I literally never went back to New York. And I kept paying my apartment, but and like I remember it was like 3 months later I got a job as an AD for this commercial in Philadelphia for this, you know, Great America, you know, amusement park.
Yeah.
And they flew me out, and then after the shoot I took a train in New York, packed up my bags, and flew back to New York. Never looked back. But I was in the system. I was in the rhythm of Propaganda Films.
Yeah.
And I remember you know, this one producer was producing this music video for Eddie Money, right?
2 Tickets to Paradise,
Eddie right? Money. Exactly, that guy, and we were doing this Eddie Money music video, and it was the first time I was working with this director, and Kim Dempster was the producer. You know, said, "Look, you know, I heard good things about you. I want you to meet, you know, this director." Work. His name is David Fincher, and you know,
I had a feeling that was going to be the name.
Yeah, and it was great. And so I did videos with David.
Mm-hmm.
And what was amazing about David was, I think that's why I was like, never could be a director. He was such a craftsman.
Yeah, yeah.
David knew everyone's job on set better than they did. He just did, and he's like. He's like one of those people hackers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he'll know who people are, and he'll just like hack them in terms of know and find their points and find their, you know. And it's like if you're on his crew and you're in his favor, he's going to know where your weaknesses are, but he'll get you there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, look. And one of the things I learned from David was we were doing this LaToya. No, not LaToya. Jody Watley. We were doing a Jody Watley video.
Okay.
And I remember we were we were putting in a foreground piece to mm-hmm. make the set look really
yeah.
bigger and stuff like that. And then there was a gag that worked after lunch, and you know, we're setting this up, and he's like, you know, is the I don't know, confetti gag working, mm-hmm. you know, ready and whatever. And I was like, oh, it works after lunch. And he pulls me aside and says, Larry, I don't care when things work. You're the AD. When you get to set, you're one of the first people here. I want you to go to every, I want you to look at the list, the shot list, and I want you to make sure that you know that every gag works before I walk on set. Just make sure. And that stuck with me. Mm-hmm. That stuck with me. I didn't get it right all the time. Trust me, you know.
No one does in this business.
Yeah, and working with David, it's because he's just literally...
He's very meticulous.
He's very meticulous. And he, you know, he churned through ADs a lot mm-hmm. Until he found, you know, the right guys. You know, he found one guy, David Warfield, who, you know, became his producer for a while until he met Sayan, who ultimately he married. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, and the thing is, you just have to be so on top of it
yeah.
with David. And it made you a better, like I became a better AD and a better production person working with David. But, you know, it's just like, you'll walk on set and like, you'll know things are going wrong with the art department or whatever. Yeah. And you just can't fix it, and you know David's coming in yeah. like 20 minutes, and you're just like, oh my God. And when he walks on set and he knows that something's wrong, mm-hmm. it's just going to be a miserable day. It's just going to be a miserable day.
It's so important to have that good AD that like you can yeah. trust.
And the other thing to remember is that we were in music videos.
Yeah.
And music videos was just like, you're shooting from the hip and you're yeah. figuring out and you're... They give you $10 and you're trying to get $1,000 worth of values. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And David knew exactly how he wanted. And the thing is, no one's as smart as David. Mm-hmm. And I remember on this Colin Hay video, Colin Hay, Can I Hold You? Was the song. It was a beautiful mm-hmm. video. Beautiful video. And I walked on set and the art department was probably 5 or 6 hours behind.
Oh, God.
I mean, literally, the set was hardly built, and you just couldn't build it fast enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, there's pressure on because, you know, what David wanted, mm-hmm. and if you ever watch the video, it's all black and white, it's beautiful, but literally, we built this beautiful apartment on the set, big windows, mm-hmm. rain gag outside, you know, thunder strikes in the background.
Yeah.
It, you know, there's a lot it's of big. Little things.
Yeah.
And it's a guy in a room singing, but it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. Then I did another video for David and for Steve Winwood called uh-huh. Roll With It. Uh-huh. That was cool, right? That was such a great video because we shot it. There was this lens called a snorkel lens. Mm-hmm. Okay, it was called a snorkel lens, and the snorkel lens. Kind of, it's exactly what it is. It's a snorkel mm-hmm. that sits on top of the camera and shoots down, uh-huh. and then there's a mirror, so that and it's really designed for tabletop. It's designed for shooting mayonnaise jars, right?
Oh, wow.
I mean, literally for tabletop food top
yeah.
commercials.
Yeah.
It was a snorkel lens, but it gave you like a really it gave you the ability to get really close. Mm-hmm. And yeah, bring it over. And so. We met with this, you know, David wanted to shoot the entire Steve Winwood Roll With It video on a snorkel lens. And I remember going over to the place where they had the snorkel lens. Which mm-hmm. video is that? Okay. So I remember with the snorkel lens, and he goes, okay, this is what I want to do, and this is what I want to do, this whole big dance number and stuff like that. And the guys were like, we never used it for that. It wasn't built that way. He goes, yeah, I know, but I want to do it this way. And he's like, all right. And these are old time
yeah.
IA camera guys, right? Yeah. These are like, these guys worked on like fucking Ben-Hur or something yeah. like that. You know, we were like in our 20s. These guys were in their 50s. Mm-hmm. And there was just a generational gap.
Yeah.
They're like, well, I guess we could do it, you know? And he goes, all right, I want to put this snorkel lens on a Lumacrane. Okay. Now, Lumacrane didn't extend, right? Mm-hmm. It was just this big long arm. Mm-hmm. And so literally, and we were, and we did the whole video. I gotta show this to you. Does that roll with it?
That's next to it is roll with it.
Okay. All right. Now, this is, this whole thing was shot in a small diner. Uh-huh. So you have a 20-foot crane inside a small diner with a remote head and then a snorkel lens with a little mirror, right? And we had 15 dancers. Now, the cool part about it was the choreographer was Paula Abdul.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, so this is all snorkel lens. All snorkel lens going along the table, and it was wild. We even shot Steve singing with the snorkel lens because it was so big we couldn't move it around.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it has this like yeah.
But we're tracking. How do I get rid of that?
It'll go off.
Okay.
It's just all right. It's in as well.
But it's like literally all these small little cutaways. Right? That was like the hardest dance moves to build because we're pulling back the camera and I'm pushing dancers in the side. Paul's on one side, I'm the other. We're literally pushing dancers in front of the
camera. Yeah.
The camera. It was wild. You know, but this was the Colin Hay video. Of course, he was big into his inserts. Those inserts would kill us. But see that? That was all built.
Oh wow.
That was all built and you know, all these,
oh, man.
Literally, right?
Yeah.
Literally on a stage.
That's
and right, the thunder gag. Yeah. You know the lightning gag. It was just like, you know. So you're sitting there, like he had all these little details. Mm-hmm. It was such a craftsman.
And he still does that with his films. Like,
yeah,
with
clothes, exactly.
Those inserts are like. There's videos on Vimeo of like Fincher inserts and like what the and how he does it.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at every one of. Like, you look at a Patti Smythe video that we did, Downtown Train, and that was a and again, that was done on a train set, right? And it looks like a real train, but we had a train set we built, and we had all these little inserts and stuff like that. But yeah, every one of those, you can look at his movies and look at his music videos.
Oh yeah,
it's all about the little and all those little shots. Took hours because it had to be right.
It wasn't some throwaway, like, let's just get it real quick. Like,
exactly. Yeah. Unroll with it. Literally, one of the guys just like, he goes like this with his neck and the button's supposed to pop off.
Uh-huh.
So that we had to shoot the shot with the button popping off. Mm-hmm. And then...
It's easier said than done.
We had a bigger button that was on a spindle that was attached to the Luma crane, and then we just dropped it as we made the button spin.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that was a 90-minute shot, and we were there for one day. You know, we had all these things. It wasn't like a 2-day shoot.
Yeah.
It was like we were there for one day. We had to get all this stuff. Those music videos were like 18-hour days. Mm-hmm. But Patti Smythe, and it was funny because during, you know, these all young kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the record, you know, I had to have my shot list, my lyric sheet, you know, so that you can look and you'd know and stuff like that. And I remember this one girl, she was brain dead. I said, make me a lyric sheet. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the tape, make me a lyric sheet, get the words done. And I didn't even check. And that's the thing with David, you had to check everything. I didn't check the lyric sheet. I didn't read it.
Yeah.
I didn't read it. The lyric, there's one lyric in the chorus that says, if I was the one, I'd be your only one, right? Mm-hmm. That was the lyric.
Mm-hmm.
And this girl, David comes to me and goes, Larry, check the lyric sheet? I was like, no, David, I was busy getting this, you know, the magician gag going. And he's like, read the chorus. I was like, I don't know the song. He goes, read the chorus. And on the lyric sheet, it says, if I was a worm, I'd be the only worm. And I was like, well
that's not right.
That's not right. He's like, no, it's not. I was like, oh, sorry. You know, it was just like...
You don't have to know the song, know that lyric.
Right, exactly. I was like, yeah, it was just so, you know, that was, but in that day, it was like, it was unbelievable. I remember I started production managing.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved away from ADing, mm-hmm. and I became a production manager. And I was working for this really great director, New York director, and we vibed, mm-hmm. right? Our producer was Phil Rose, English guy. I became his production manager. And again, we were in this storefront building on La Brea, and propaganda was just, it started to blow
up,
right? Started to get more directors in the building mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And everyone's working, everyone's busting their ass, everyone's, you know, and I'm sitting there, calling in a camera package mm-hmm. and typing the crew list. And there was this kid in a cubicle across the way, and he was just sitting there doing nothing. He had a brown paper bag, like his lunch, next to him by the phone. He's just sitting there hanging out, you know?
Uh-huh.
And it just pissed the hell out of me. I was just like, everyone in this, you know, small little storefront place was busting their ass. Mm-hmm. And this kid's just sitting there. And after like watching him like three or four times, like glancing up, it was like a bee in my bonnet.
Yeah.
And I turned to the kid and I called from across the aisle. I was like, yo. I was like, hey. I was like, what are you doing? He goes, nothing. I was like, no, I know it looks like it. And I said, what are you doing? He goes, I'm really just here waiting for the phone to ring. And I was like, really? And he said, yeah. I was like, why? And he said, in case the band gets arrested, there's $10,000 cash in this brown paper bag. I was like, you're kidding me.
He's like, that's my only job.
Yeah, he goes, that's my job. I said, that's your job? He goes, that's my job. He's like, I'm getting paid $75 to sit by this phone with $10,000 cash in a brown paper bag waiting for the phone to ring just in case the band gets arrested. I was like, oh my God, what job are you on? And he picks up the little call sheet. He goes, and shows it to me. He goes, you too. And the video was Where the Streets Have No Name.
Oh, wow.
And that's the one they shot where they're on top of a liquor store.
Oh, okay.
So if you watch that video, uh-huh. they did get shut down. They didn't get arrested, but literally...
It's like...
Yeah, they wanted the band to get arrested.
So when watching that video, I will see some guy in a cubicle, like...
You will we don't think know. That... Yeah, exactly. There's this guy in a cubicle just
waiting on La Brea.
Just waiting on La Brea, just in case the band gets arrested. That was the genius of that company.
Yeah.
That company was like the bar house of, mm-hmm. of the 80s in music video. And then, you know, I worked with Nigel Dick, who's a great music video director. Mm-hmm. And then I remember Anne-Marie Mackay, the mm-hmm. most amazing woman, one of the founders of Propaganda. And we moved into this really cool building on Mansfield. You mm-hmm. know, we were like in the height. We were doing Madonna videos. Yeah. We were doing Guns N' Roses. Mm-hmm. You know, we were doing everything. It was the place to be, right? You were there.
Yeah.
You lived there. They even had a cafe in there, which people just came just to hang out.
Yeah.
It was just that kind of a place.
Google, but early.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was like. Yeah. It was like Google, but early. It was the coolest place to work.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in film, you wanted to be in music videos, you wanted to be a propaganda. And I remember Anne-Marie Mackay brought me into her office and said, I just signed a new director. She was English. Just signed a new director, love. And I want you to... produce his first mm-hmm. music video for him, and he's just out of Pasadena Arts, Cal Arts. He was mm-hmm. out of Cal Arts and stuff like that. I was like, Anne-Marie, whatever you want me to do, happy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, lovely, lovely. He's right here, Michael, come on in. And I was like, Larry, this is Michael Bay. and we have this job slaughter for him. Wow. Up all night.
Yeah.
So the video was Slaughter Up All Night that I produced for him. It was mm-hmm. Michael Bay's first music video.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he was like the new young Fincher.
Yeah.
And you would see, like a lot of these guys would take their reels, would take the other director's reels and just study it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay to do that.
Yeah.
You know? I remember... doing this one music video for Jennifer Warren, mm-hmm. Bill Medley and Jennifer Warren's. Mm-hmm. It was for Dirty Dancing, the time of your life.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's funny because if you look at that video, there's a lot of Super 8 footage that we used in there. And Jennifer Warrens didn't show up that day because she was in rehab. Mm-hmm. So we shot a PA, did up her hair, and shot her in silhouette.
Oh, wow.
And the record company made us shoot it after, you know, when she came back.
Yeah,
she came back. But we had to reshoot that one scene. But there's a lot of Super 8 footage in there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was like Greg Gold directed it. But he called all the directors. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, I got all these Super 8 cameras. Come down. And so like David Fincher's walking around shooting Super 8, you know.
And this just ends up in the video.
That's all in the video. Yeah, wow. it's really cool. But that's what, so that's how it was. So when Michael Bay would take Fincher's reel and study it, that was okay.
Yeah.
You know, because they mentored these younger directors, you know, and Michael would, you know, call up David and David, you know, he'd sit on set and he'd watch and he'd sit in the editing
room.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. And then, so I worked with Michael and then I locked into a director named Antoine Fuqua. And I started, I was Antoine's producer for a number of years, and he and I really gelled. He was wonderful, and he was amazing. Probably the nicest guy I've ever worked with.
He was
just so wonderful. Not only was he nice, he was just cool.
Yeah.
I mean, when Antoine walked on set, man, it was just like the coolest thing in the world. He just had the vibe.
Yeah.
You know, and he was quiet.
Very different than Fincher is what it sounds like.
Yeah, a lot different than Fincher. Yeah. But, you know, everyone had their own style, which was beautiful about Propaganda. They really... But Anton was just cool. He was just so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the thing. And then there was a... You know, Propaganda got bought. Mm-hmm. And when it got bought by the company, the culture changed.
Yeah.
And some
which
of the founders...
Which usually happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Some of the founders moved off. Mm-hmm. And Anne-Marie started a company called Palomar Pictures. Mm-hmm. I wasn't one of the first producers of Propaganda. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I was in the swing of things, but I wanted to be at a company where it was just, I wanted to be at the ground level.
Yeah.
So when Anne-Marie opened up Palomar, I went over to Palomar. And we had some really great directors there too. And there was a director there who started out as a post-production supervisor.
Okay.
And he was really into special effects, and he was a post-production supervisor. And the Anne-Marie's partner was a guy by the name of Jonathan Carr, who I'm actually working with now.
Mm-hmm.
And Jonathan ran commercials, and Anne-Marie ran music videos.
Yeah.
And then there was Tony Schiff, who ran special projects. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan, JK, was like, Larry, I need you to, one of our directors, new director, he's done a couple of music videos, and now he's, you know, I got him his first commercial.
Yeah.
I need you to do a budget for him. It's these frogs, and they're talking, and we're going over to Stan Winston.
Okay.
To talk to him about it and stuff like that. I was like, great, great. And that director, that young director who started as a post-production supervisor, was a kid by the name of Gore Verbinski.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if we've talked about him on the show, but we've talked about him, like, how he's, like, great at doing these huge, like, big set pieces. And that makes sense, coming from, like, post-production and all that now. Yeah.
He loved effects.
And yeah.
He was like Fincher.
Uh-huh.
In a way, because that's why I couldn't be a director, because that back then in the 80s, you had to know everything in terms of special effects.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where all this stuff was going.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't like you could do Woody Allen back in the 80s, you know? It's like these guys were like, you had to know special effects, you had to know lighting and stuff like that. Gore was different than David. In a way, Gore was just more quiet, but as difficult, right? Because all these guys were demanding for a reason. I mean, their work is beautiful. But I remember us driving out to the Valley from Hollywood. It was JK, Gore and myself, and we had a certain amount of money for this Budweiser Frogs commercial.
Okay.
It was the first one.
Yeah.
And Gore didn't want to do the Frogs CG. It was too expensive, way too expensive. So the best way to do it was animatronics.
Yeah.
And so we're thinking about the budget and stuff like that. And we're like, you know what? Maybe we can get these frogs for like, you know, $35,000-$40,000. That's what we'll do. We'll walk in and we'll just, you know, we'll tell Stan we got
this much money
and blah, 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 right? And we had our game plan.
Yeah.
We had our game plan going in to see Stan Winston, right? And we walk in and Stan Winston Studios was like in Van Nuys, and you walked in through this door. And then they brought you into the meeting room.
Okay.
And in the meeting room is the Terminator. Right? The mock of the Terminator. A piece of dinosaur from Jurassic Park. Okay. All like these great set pieces. It was such a fuck you room. Right?
Yeah.
It was literally
$35,000.
Amazing, right? But it wasn't even like that. We're like, and it was such a fuck you room. It was such an intimidating room because literally, like, you know, these are my trophies.
Yeah.
And we walk in and Stan, you know, nice, really nice guy, really nice guy. He has a little gray beard and he's, you know, kind of on the shorter side. And he sits down and he's like, okay, went through it and stuff like that. It's going to cost $125,000. And literally, Jonathan, who was the head of the company, he's like, okay. There was not even discussion. No. We didn't even bring up $40,000.
Oh, my gosh.
Because you're surrounded by all this stuff. He goes, it's going to cost $125,000. We're like, okay.
We believe you.
You know, it wasn't even we believe it, it was just like, okay. Because you're sitting there, what am I going to say?
Like,
yeah, exactly. What are you going to say? You've got like the Terminator staring down at you.
No, you have to get a cheaper stand.
Right,
like.
Exactly. And then he walked us through the shop.
Oh, wow.
He walked us through the shop and they were doing Congo at the time.
Yeah.
So you were seeing like,
which I kind of love growing up. I don't know why.
You saw the gorillas. Gorilla. You saw the eyes. You saw all the, you know, the guys. What? And so it's like, you knew that you were getting the benefit of all this tech.
Yeah. You're getting the best in the business pretty much. Yeah.
Exactly. And so we're like, all right.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
And that commercial, which was Gore's first commercial, won a Cannes Lion. It went into the Cannes Hall of Fame.
Oh,
you know, it was just like, it was amazing. But those, you know, these companies, my career has always been about identifying with the next generation of talent. Always about finding talent who reached the youth audience. And that's what I love doing, right?
Yeah.
It's not about resting on your laurels and things like that. I just like moving. I just like constantly moving and finding the next young talent and breaking it out. And I remember in 1995 at Palomar, I got a PlayStation 1. Okay, had my computer and I started playing this game called Half-Life.
Okay.
All right. The first Half-Life. Yeah, the Mac version. Okay. Mac version of Half-Life. And I was like, this is cool. And then I got a PlayStation 1 and I started playing a game called Abe's Odyssey.
Okay.
Oddworld. Did you ever play it?
I did not.
You gotta play it.
Okay.
Do you have Steam? Do you have a Steam account?
I do not, but I can get one.
Okay. Get one and play these games. Mm-hmm. Play The Stranger and stuff like that. Great. And what I saw on Oddworld was these great characters made out of CG. And I was playing it for like hours. And Half-Life, I played for, you know, hours. And it scared the hell out of me. I got scared playing Half-Life. And I was like, this is the next thing. And that's when I started to get involved in video games. And I started to get my directors involved in video games. Like Mitch Walker, who I was producing for, we did three games for Electronic Arts where we directed. He directed, I produced all the film sequences for like Soviet Strike, Nuclear Strike, Progress 3D. We did the film segments for those. And this is just after they did this game called Wing Commander, where they spent like $10 million on their cinematics. And I was telling them, why'd you do that? right? He's like, well, you know, because I was trying to get my directors to do those. I said, my directors can do it. It's like, oh, no, you Hollywood guys, we just, you know, we're all upset because we just spent $10 million on Wing Commander doing the... I was like, Wing Commander, you just tried to do Star Wars in a video game. You know, you just tried to film it.
Yeah.
He goes, and who directed that? He goes, oh, one of our game designers. I was like, well, there you go.
That's the problem.
Yeah. I was like, how much do you have? And he goes, we only have like $500,000 for these. No, we had $250,000 for the cinematics, right? Uh-huh. And I think he was undercutting me. Guy by the name of Rod Swanson, nicest guy in the world. I said, I'll do it. He goes, really? He's like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, but... I said, Rod, I'm telling you. He goes, what if you go over budget? I was like, then I eat it. And so I got Mitch Walker to do the cinematics for Nuclear or Soviet Strike, which was a PlayStation 1 game, a little helicopter game. And it was a great game. And I sit down with Electronic Arts. I says, okay, here we are. We're going to shoot it in L.A., Prague, and Amsterday. And he's like, what? We can't do all that.
For $250,000.
Like, right. I was like, yeah, we can. Yeah. And I remember the first day on the set, we shot it at Lacey Street. And so we found like a warehouse that we can have all these different looks for all the prison scenes, like all the you know, Soviet bloc type scenes, the interiors with the actors. And then we walked on set, and Electronic Arts was like, where are the cameras? And I was like, oh, here they come. And literally it was a PA coming up from like a Best Buy with a Best Buy bag with like all these Sony digital Hi8 cameras that we bought for like $800.
Yeah.
He's like, you're not shooting this on 35 or 16? I was like, why? She's like, you're going to take this film, you're going to crunch it down, it's going to be in a window, 1x2, in a video game on a 32-bit machine. You don't need that resolution.
No.
It's like, that's why you guys spent $10 million on Wing Commander.
We're spending $250,000.
Right, exactly. We're
in just multiple shooting locations,
And they were like, okay. And the game was phenomenal, and the cinematics won all these awards, and I got into the game business that way.
And so you did that for a while, and then
I did that for a while, and then
you got the CAA was in 2000, or
it was in 2000, and I that was like we shot, you know, Road Rash in like 97, 98, and then we started to make our own video games. I saw how hard that was, you know, because with Palomar we formed a joint venture with Electronic Arts because we had a good relationship with EA then because we were doing great work for them, and I said, you know, I see how you guys make your video games. I think there's a different way. I think you don't need to own the art department and all these people. It's like all you really need are your coders.
Yeah.
You can outsource everything else. So we formed this little game studio in Melbourne, Australia. And I used an art department that we worked with on commercials. And so I had this little company, this special effects company, as my art department, my freelance art department in Australia. And we were making two games for Electronic Arts. And these games were amazing, at least the cinematics. The CG elements we were creating for was amazing. It was called Splinter. One game was called Splinter. And it was about a micro emergency response craft. Like, you shrunk it down and you were flying through, like, you know, the back walls and stuff like that. And you were fighting ants and all these things in the world looking for a missing micro weapon. Okay? But my art department was this company in Sydney called Animalogic.
Okay.
Animalogic did all our special effects for Gore, all our artwork on our commercials.
Yeah.
Then they also did a movie called The Matrix. Then they also did a movie called Happy Feet. Ultimately, they did the Lego movie and stuff like that. But Animalogic is one of the best, you know, CG houses in the world. But that was our art department, you know? I had Baz Luhrmann's sound guys as my sound team.
As your sound team for video games.
Yeah, it was amazing. A company called Thunder Tracks in Melbourne. So, you know, we're trying to bring those kinds of elements.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I was, you know, what happened was those games died because we were making games for PC. And the PlayStation 1 started to just skyrocket. Yeah. So Electronic Arts killed all the PC SKUs. So I moved back to the States. But I knew that games were the next generation.
Future,
that was the future. And these game designers were amazing. And so I took a meeting at CAA, and I said, I really believe in these next generation of creators called game designers. Mm-hmm. And I think I went to them to see if they would introduce me to a movie studio because I wanted to open up a division for video games in a movie studio. And they're like, that's so cool. Do you want to be an agent and represent game designers? Yeah. This was in 2000. I was like, sure. You know? So I literally started the games division at CAA. Mm-hmm. And coming from production, I knew I knew what I wanted. So I went after, number one, my favorite game creators, yeah. like Lauren Lanning of mm-hmm. Oddworld. I went after Will Wright,
because
I love SimCity.
Mm-hmm.
And I went after all the game engines.
Yeah.
Because I thought that you can take game engines and make real-time animation movies.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed Valve as a client,
okay.
Epic, and id.
Mm-hmm.
So I had Doom, Half-Life, and Quake. They're all my clients.
Yeah.
And then I signed Xbox.
Mm-hmm. Which was...
And, yeah. And so, it was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And being an agent at CAA was mm-hmm. amazing. You're like, you're sitting in these meetings and you see, there is not a single thing that happens in Hollywood that doesn't go through those doors.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I hear that's like, I haven't worked at an agency, but that's the like hub of information, yeah, essentially.
Yeah, information, access. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have CAA after your title,
mm-hmm.
you can call anyone.
Yeah.
They'll call you back. Seriously. Yeah, it's like, hey, I have Larry Shapiro from CAA. You know, please hold. You know, all right. You know, or they'll call you back.
Yeah.
It's just like, and you think when you leave the agency that you still have that.
Mm-hmm. You don't.
You don't, man. You just
It goes away.
It's so true. Because you're like, you know, you're at a company. What's amazing is when you're at these agencies and you're calling someone, they don't know if you're calling about Tom Cruise or Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
You could be.
Yeah.
You rep them, mm-hmm. so to speak. When you leave the agency world, they know exactly who you are and why you're calling.
Yep.
So, you know, your calls don't get returned that quickly after.
Wow.
But I was an agent for 7 years, mm-hmm. and I had my run, and then I saw that there's a change in the game industry. It was mm-hmm. changing. It wasn't about game directors, game mm-hmm. designers. It was more about franchise. They were taking mm-hmm. the studio approach in terms of they needed to make less games mm-hmm. and more money into them.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, that's when the GTAs and mm-hmm. you know, and the Halos of the world started taking off.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't like it anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I just kind of left.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Tull, who started Legendary, was mm-hmm. opening up this new game publishing mm-hmm. company called Brash. He raised about $100 million, and that was in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to jump. I'm going to get in on the ground floor.
Yeah.
Always chasing the tail.
Yeah.
Always chasing the tail. And that was in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
No one knew what was ahead, but there was this thing called the financial crisis.
Yeah.
And most of the money that Thomas raised was against debt, and they couldn't secure the debt, and the company fell apart.
Mm.
And so I was out, right? The company shuttered. And so I just, you know, then I just focused on online mm-hmm. creators. I just, you know, and worked with you know, at a company called Fourth Wall, which was mm-hmm. amazing. That was founded by the most creative guy I know mm-hmm. named Alon Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened for a couple of years, and then we lost our funding. And Alon went on. He went a completely different way.
Yeah.
He went from, we were doing like AR technology, mm-hmm. augmented reality, and we were building a platform where you would be watching online video and we make your cell phone ring and
you could
hear certain things on your cell phone and what it was like a dual screen
experience,
but it was interactive. It was so genius.
Mm-hmm.
This guy Alon Lee is just so creative. But his next venture was completely lo-fi.
Okay.
Well, he went on to work at Microsoft Studios and uh-huh. then they shuttered that.
Yeah.
And then he's like, all right, you know what? I'm going completely lo-fi. I'm going back to my roots of game design. He was mm-hmm. like one of the brilliant game designers. And he used to be a client of mine at mm-hmm. CAA. And he did a Kickstarter campaign.
Uh-huh.
He hooked up with an animation friend of his, and they made this little card game, and they went on Kickstarter, and that turned out to be Exploding Kittens.
Oh gosh, that game,
right?
Yeah.
And so he's making money hand over fist.
That was just a few years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally lo-fi. Yeah. Totally lo-fi.
I'm going back to my roots. And right? It's a card game.
Exactly. And you know, and I focused, you know, when I was at Fourth Wall and we were trying to build this dual screen platform, mm-hmm. we spent $1 million making this pilot mm-hmm. for our platform, like our mm-hmm. showcase piece. Spent $1 million making 3 episodes of this show called Dirty Work. Mm-hmm. Okay? And if you look on it online, it's actually really good. Mm-hmm. It stars Jamie Clayton.
Was it nominated for an Emmy, right?
Or it won an Emmy.
Won an Emmy, okay, yeah.
Jamie Clayton it stars. Uh-huh. Marilyn Reichgub.
Okay.
It's actually a really good show. Mm-hmm. So watch it, everybody who's listening. If this doesn't get edited
we'll post a link to it.
Yeah, because it's really good. And we have the non-interactive version on it.
Yeah.
But what was funny about that was we spent $1 million making that. We won an Emmy. Mm-hmm. No one showed. No one showed to our platform.
Oh, okay. Gosh.
But we won an Emmy. We're like, all right, we're walking around the office holding our Emmy. Exactly. But that's what I learned. Mm-hmm. And my son at the time, who was 11, mm-hmm. was watching this YouTube video of this director, Mystery Guitar Man. Mm-hmm. And I loved his work. I was looking at it. It was like coming out of music videos. I love this guy. Mm-hmm. He was great. And so I reached out to him. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, I want you to make something for our platform. He said, okay. I said, I'll give you $35,000 to make something. He's like, okay. And he handed me a 45-page script. I was like, dude, I just wanted like a 3-minute video. He goes, yeah, but this is what I want to make. I said, you don't have enough money to make this.
No.
And he says, yes, I do. I was like, how? You got stunts in here. You got these big props. You got a lot of extras. He goes, yeah, but I have 1 million followers. I reached out and to my Twitter fans and I said, hey, I need someone who does props. And, you know, and then there was this ambulance driver who's a fan of mine. He's going to loan us the ambulance. I was like, holy shit. I was like, I see how you're going to do this.
Yeah.
You literally just outsourced everything mm-hmm. through your own distribution of mm-hmm. your fans. And it's the hive mind. It's like literally the hive mentality. Mm-hmm. I get it. I was like, you know what? Let's do it. And we made this thing. And it's on Mystery Guitar Man's channel. It's called mm-hmm. Meridian. And we put it on our dual screen platform as well. We had more traffic come to our site mm-hmm. with spending $35,000, like literally by 1,200%.
Yeah.
As like, I get it. Mm-hmm. That's where I want to be. Mm-hmm. I want to be working with these creators. And so I literally, when Fourth Wall lost our funding, I started working with YouTube creators mm-hmm. because that's the next generation of talent, because they're creators who reach...
They're getting directed to the audience, yeah.
And this whole direct-to-audience distribution, mm-hmm. this direct-to-audience relationship, we're still at the nascent stage of what that power is. Mm-hmm.
I think last year or year before when they surveyed a lot of like teens or younger, and the top 25 most powerful people in their eyes, and like there were more YouTube personalities were more yeah. popular and more. Had more say in the kid's life than most movie stars do.
Well, what's
changed in the past, like, just 5 years.
Exactly. And what's interesting about this next generation of creators mm-hmm. is this is a first generation of artist creators who analyze data.
Yeah.
Okay. You look at some of these kids, they know exactly where their audience is. They know what their top cities are. Mm-hmm. They know what their top countries are. They know how long... They have a direct relationship with them. They know who's texting them, who's mm-hmm. who's commenting on them, and stuff like that. And what's interesting is this generation of every new generation creates their own stars. Every platform mm-hmm. creates their own stars. And when you look at, because the kids who are growing up, I tell this story a lot with David Fincher. Let's mm-hmm. okay. In 1988, at Propaganda, Fincher directed Loverboy. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was 1988. Those 15, 16-year-old kids that started watching MTV are the audience that are paying $10 a month just to watch House of Cards. Okay.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The directors back then who shaped the teens literally were the ones who became the big consumers of online entertainment today. Now you have this generation of kids who are have a, an even closer relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And in 10 years from now, who knows what's going to happen with what these kids are going to create.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what Lance 210 is going to do? Who knows what Laura Cleary is going to create in 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
But Laura Cleary is a force of nature.
Mm-hmm.
She is such a great talent. And she gets on, she wakes up, she opens up Snapchat, she looks at the filter, she creates a new character. Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know? She created that one character, the Steven character. Mm-hmm. Her name is Helen Horvath. Horvath. And that character has such a following around the mm-hmm. world. Laura put her face on a t-shirt, which was created, the face was created by Fan. Uh-huh. Fan. Right, she got the permission to use the fan art, created a shirt. She sold thousands of shirts. And she didn't have to get it into Macy's or, mm-hmm. or you know, Hot Topic. She just went to Represent, which mm-hmm. was a company who facilitated this mm-hmm. through online, direct to audience. That's where we are. It's disintermediation, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, you're cutting out the middleman,
mm-hmm.
right? This generation, my son, he doesn't know from calling a cab company to get a cab.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to go to, you know, he just hits Uber.
Uber or Lyft or whatever.
He wants McDonald's. He doesn't drive. He just goes Grubhub. And 20 minutes later,
it's some here.
Young college kid is delivering his you know, his Chicken McNuggets.
And that's something I bring up because it's relevant, I think, right now when going back to, taking it back to film, is that a lot of people don't understand how to use that ability.
Yeah.
It's like, because I remember this past year when I'd read a script for someone and they're asking me, like, who should be this star, like, in this movie? And I'm like, oh, I think if you want to go, like, against type of this character, you go someone like with Emma Watson. And they're like, she doesn't really have, like, a big box office pull. And I'm like, really? I was like, if you look at her movies, you're right. But when you look at her, like, social media presence, like, she has a big audience.
Yeah.
And with Beauty and the Beast coming out, it's kind of the first time I've actually seen them talk about a star's social media presence.
Yeah.
Because they're saying, like, one reason why it will do so well is because she has this huge following. Even though besides Harry Potter, she's, like, mostly released indie films.
Yeah.
But, like, Hollywood doesn't see her as a box office draw because she's not doing, like, Hunger Games or whatever.
And we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
I'm a big Emma Watson fan.
I think
she's fantastic. It's, you know, again, I think the difference is, though, what I think what Hollywood's forgetting
mm-hmm.
is that the entertainment behavior is changing.
Yeah.
Right? When MTV happened, there was an entertainment behavior
mm-hmm.
that changed, right? And what that was, what people really don't understand about what MTV did,
mm-hmm.
was MTV created social watching.
Yeah.
You got together with your friends
mm-hmm.
to watch. I remember, I'm dating myself, back in high school,
mm-hmm.
all my friends went to Jason Steinberg's house to watch the premiere of Jump by Van Halen.
Yeah.
Okay? And we watched it together.
Mm-hmm.
When we were in college, you'd get into the room,
mm-hmm.
four or five, six people, and we'd watch music videos and we'd talk about it.
Yeah.
And the artistic imitation of that was Beavis and Butthead.
Mm-hmm.
Two guys sitting on it, talking, you know. Okay. That's what we were.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're a bunch of Beavis and Buttheads just sitting there. Video games do that as well. What people don't realize is with video games, you literally back in the day before online video games, mm-hmm. you know, there was at least, Activision said there was always at least four people in the room when they were playing a game. What Hollywood doesn't understand now is with cell phone, you know, with smartphones,
mm-hmm.
the audience doesn't want to go to the movie theaters. They don't care. They just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's, you know, even with someone like with Emma Watson, who's got, you know, this huge following,
mm-hmm.
they might not go to the movie theaters because it's not important to them.
Yeah.
It's a $25 experience, you know what? They rather buy a few iTunes songs and order Grubhub. Right? Mm-hmm. And so that's the difference. Mm-hmm. So today's entertainment has to change. And they have to figure out what that next... I'm bearish on VR, mm-hmm. right? I don't know about VR because mm-hmm. you're putting on a headset,
yeah.
you're blocking off all social, mm-hmm. and you're sitting there in a room looking around, and mm-hmm. who knows what people are doing.
Yeah.
Today's entertainment behavior is changing, mm-hmm. and people are watching on their cell phones. Mm-hmm. And so just like in music videos, filmmakers had a hard time making music videos. But young kids who wanted to break into film mm-hmm. were the guys who were making the music videos. Mm-hmm. And then they changed. Same thing here. Mm-hmm. Now everyone's watching smartphones. There's a new generation of filmmaker that's emerging.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's what I love. And mm-hmm. I see that because I lived it. Mm-hmm. I've seen it all throughout my career. So when I look at next generation of filmmakers, I think Matt Enlow. Mm-hmm. I think Scott D.W. Mm-hmm. I think Tim H., who came out of USC.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's all these new filmmakers that are emerging. So that's really where, you know, that's what I see. So if you're, you know, when people say, oh, how do I break into film? Mm-hmm. You don't have to break into film anymore. You just have to film.
Yeah.
You have your camera, you go make it, you mm-hmm. put it online. You build an audience. You build your own audience.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between now. That's the difference between film school in the 80s and 90s and film school now. You don't really, you know, do you need film school? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's techniques and other things, but that's where you meet your friends.
Yeah.
And that's where you experiment. That's where you find your voice. Mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. If you can afford it, all the better.
Yeah.
But today, to break in the film... You know, I have kids who are like saying, I'm just going to go. I remember I was working with Devin Supertramp. Mm-hmm. Devin Supertramp, he's now got 3.5 million people yeah, yeah. following him and stuff like that. But I remember putting him in a room with Lorenzo de Bonaventura, mm-hmm. okay, who makes yeah. small little movies like Transformers.
Yeah, just those
you
big,
know, just
yeah.
like Deepwater Horizon. Just very just small very movies. Small, you know,
$100 million.
Independent,
at least,
you know.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Kickstarter and, videos, yeah.
And Lorenzo, because Lorenzo always, he's smart. Mm-hmm. Lorenzo's such a smart producer, and he always loves to meet new filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And we're developing something with him.
Yeah.
It's Scott D.W. And I remember putting him in a room with Devin, and Lorenzo's like, you know, we should make a movie together. You know, we should, you mm-hmm. know, I got one of the Transformers coming out. Maybe you can, you know, do some, you know, additional
yeah.
like short films around yeah. it for the marketing and things, but we should really, you know, make something together and stuff. And Devin looks at him in all his beautiful, you know, charisma and just innocence, because mm-hmm. he's just, you know, he's just amazing and such a wonderful, wonderful guy. And he looks at Lorenzo and says, yeah, I don't know, I'd rather just make my own movie and sell it directly to my fans. And Lorenzo was dumbfounded, but he's smart enough to say, you know what? You're fucking right. You could do that.
You could do that.
You know, because again, that's what makes Lorenzo such a great producer, mm-hmm. because he does keep his finger on the pulse.
Yeah,
he
and that's does, the big you know? Thing. Yeah.
And but like these kids who have these huge audiences, they don't need... Laura Cleary doesn't need a studio. Mm-hmm. Laura Cleary gets, you know, asked to audition for pilots. All this, you know, this whole pilot season, she's been, you know, requested to read, you know, on 5 different pilots. Mm-hmm. She's passed on all of them. She's like, you know what? I'm having too much fun making my own content mm-hmm. that I own and
yeah.
sending it to my fans directly. Mm-hmm.
If you have that creative control, you can pick and choose what
if
you want
to
do.
If you have that audience.
Yeah, if you have that audience.
And it's a disintermediation. Mm-hmm. It's what's happening. The minute you put that phone, that smartphone, directly in the audience's hand and you have yeah. a way to get to them directly, look at... Uber mm-hmm. is the largest cab company mm-hmm. that doesn't own a cab. Airbnb, mm-hmm. the largest hospitality company, doesn't own a hotel.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the same thing is going to mm-hmm. happen to movie studios.
Yeah.
It's like Facebook is one of the largest media companies that doesn't make content.
Yeah. It's people who are doing it. The users that are doing it. And
it's disintermediation. Mm-hmm. You don't need... If I'm a creator and I have 2 million fans following me, I don't need a studio to market my movie.
Yeah.
I just tweet.
Yeah.
I'll just put up an Instagram. And that's the brilliance. And that's the opportunity for anyone who wants to break into film now. It's like there's a new way of going about it. And, you know, I represent Grant Thompson, King of Random. Mm-hmm. And he's got almost 8 million followers on YouTube. And he makes videos every single day that are, you know, over a million views on average. He gets a one rating every day. You know, but males 18 to 35, he's got that audience down pat.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, too, is that you can see, like you said earlier, you can see the data of, like, what's going on. And, like, if you go out with Uber, I remember, like, someone telling me, like, Uber can, like, see the data of, like, what the traffic patterns are with, like, the city or whatever. And, like, and it's become more than just that. It comes, like, Uber Eats or, like, whatever. You can do so much with it. And
look at Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon has all this data. They're sending things directly to people. They have this working relationship with them.
Yeah.
This one-on-one relationship through merchandising, right? Through retail. Mm-hmm. They did this. And they own no stores.
Yeah.
Right? You know, they have a distribution channel, but they have the relationship and they gave the audience a way to do things differently. They gave them a solution. They gave them a user experience. Mm-hmm. They gave them a user experience that worked. Then they started, with all that data, they said, hey, how about a movie? Right?
Yeah.
How about a TV show?
Mm-hmm.
Now I've got a thing called Transparent.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll like that. We actually know you'll like it because we have all
the data.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay? But what's interesting is they got into entertainment by offering a user experience, right? Everyone talks about, oh, you know, content is king and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of user experience is king, right? Get them into a way of behaving. You can get them anything. Another case in point, right, was Netflix.
Yeah.
Right? I'll give you a new user experience. I know everyone's running out to Blockbuster and stuff like that. You know what? Don't schlep out to Blockbuster. Don't worry about parking and stuff like that. I'll mail them to you. I'll give you a user experience. Give me your credit card. Pay me monthly. I'll give you a new user experience. Reed knew what he was doing. That's why he called the company Netflix. He knew ultimately where he wanted to go.
Yeah.
He got an audience.
Yeah.
He built an audience through a user experience. And then he fed him his own content.
And Netflix has become a studio. Like, they're not, they're just, they're a studio and a distribution. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. But they started by bringing a user experience.
Yeah.
Just like Uber. Mm-hmm. Uber brought a user experience. Now they're doing, you know, now they're doing everything from delivering food to, you know, it's like, they'll become the next FedEx.
Yeah.
Right? That's what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So with entertainment, it's really all about building audience.
Yeah.
Building audience, creating that experience, creating that relationship. Mm-hmm. Then you can feed them any kind of content.
Mm-hmm. Two quick questions or final questions that we do. Looking back on what you've done, your career, what advice would you give to your younger self if you're starting today? You kind of already touched on a little bit, but what would you do differently, I guess?
Drop the ego, be nicer, work hard. Be nice to everyone, work hard. Literally. And actually stop chasing the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Go to where the ball's going. I chased a lot.
Yeah.
I chased a lot. I went from one place to one place to one place instead of just focusing and drilling down hard and just staying. Right? I should have stayed Antoine Fuqua's producer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I should have just stayed there and enjoyed it and lived it. And, you know, look, he got a great career.
Mm-hmm.
I left producing for Antoine because they were looking for a producer for this television show called Salute Your Shorts. And I went on to Salute
Your Shorts. Which I love Salute Your Shorts, by the way.
Okay.
Okay.
But I went on, I was associate producer on that because I wanted to get in the long form.
Yeah.
I just kept chasing.
Yeah.
I kept chasing the ball like all those kids on a soccer field instead of going to where the ball's going.
Yeah.
Think about where it's all going.
Mm. A good piece of advice, actually. And last question, because we do mostly film stuff and we always end this interviews with this, what are your top five favorite films?
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Okay.
The Graduate,
which is in my top five as well.
Once upon a time in America.
Okay.
Goodfellas.
Okay.
And probably Animal House.
I love John Belushi. See, Blues Brothers is my number one favorite movie just because of John Belushi. Yeah. But yeah,
That's the quickest anyone's ever answered that question on the show. Because everyone goes, oh God, I can't think of any movies right now. Like, what do I need to do? And so that it takes a while sometimes.
Right. I can watch those movies all the time. Uh-huh. And, you know, of course we all have.
Yeah.
But like my first three
are
always going to be Butch Cassidy, Graduate, Once Upon a Time in America. I just love those movies. And Goodfellas, how can you not love that movie? It's so great. And being a Jersey boy and having my, you know, some of my family members intersecting, like, you know, the Jewish mob back in the 50s and 40s and 50s. But Graduate is just like, Butch Cassidy is just like, you know.
It's amazing, yeah. When I saw Graduate the first time when I was in high school, and I was like, this is amazing. This is what, like, there's certain movies, like, when you're growing up and you want to be a filmmaker, when you see it, you're like, this is what I want to do. Like, Graduate.
This is it.
Yeah, like, Graduate was that for me. Annie Hall was one for me, which is very difficult nowadays and the way the industry is. But, like, those are the ones when I watched, I was just like,
yeah,
I found what I want. Like, that's...
It's funny, because I love Annie Hall. Uh-huh. I mean, Woody Allen was, like, why I got into film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I love Woody Allen. And so, you know, that's up there too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that would replace Animal House.
Yeah.
You know, but he's amazing. I also like The Purple Rose of Cairo.
That's in my top three with this.
Yeah.
Like, it's very funny coming from a guy from Alabama who just fell in love with Woody Allen. Like,
right?
When I was a junior in high school, I was like, I've never seen a movie by him.
Yeah,
but
it's
great.
But yeah, Purple Rose of Cairo is great. But Annie Hall is, you know, because I lived in New York and he was amazing.
Yeah. Well, Larry, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.